I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. And something is not connecting here. Elected representatives right across this country are telling us at every opportunity that we should, if we're not already, get married. It is, they tell us, a win, win, win. It's good for us, it's good for the children, and it's good for the country. What's more, the latest word from Washington is that politicians there are ready to put over $1 billion into a new campaign to hear those wedding bells ring. Expect more next week when the president makes his annual speech to the nation. However, the latest research of the state of the personal union tells a dramatically different story. A study from the University of Chicago says more and more people are choosing to stay single for more of their lives than at any time ever measured. This extension of America's single urban tribes points toward a great and growing gulf between the way people are choosing to live and the way that policymakers would like them to live. Today we're looking at the new cultures and markets and lifestyles of the single American. We do need your perspective, though. Is being single in America something different today? How do you make sense of the many people who are delaying or avoiding marriage precisely at the moment when policymakers are urging them to do otherwise? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're going to start today's show with the man who led this latest research. It's called the Chicago Health and Social Life Survey. And we're joined by Edward Laumann, who's a professor of sociology at the University of Chicago. Professor, it's good to have you with us.
Very good to be here.
What's the headline here?
Well, the study that I'm reporting is based upon a very extensive survey of people living in Chicago. We have a cross-section survey of about 1,000 people, which can represent a baseline for people living in Cook County, which includes the inner city as well as the immediate suburbs, as well as four localities that were selected to be sort of neighborhoods that have distinctive populations different from other parts of the population, for example, a Mexican area, an African-American area, and the single scene and gay community in Chicago.
So what was it that surprised you when you added it all up and looked at what you'd gathered?
Well, I think it's we're in a position to estimate the percentage of time or the amount of time spent over the course of the 42 years between 18 and 59, which is our sample range, that has been in different kinds of partnership relationships. And we estimate that about 18 years will be spent as a married person, 3.7 years as a cohabbing, living with someone, and about half your time will be spent as a single person, and about 10 years of that, 20 years, is going to be without a partner.
Half your time spent as a single person. How much of a contrast is that to data that would have been collected back in the 40s and the 50s?
Well, I think it's useful to remember in 1950, which is the beginning of sort of the baby boom generation, that the median age of marriage was 22 for men and 20 for women. That is now pushing 27 for men and 24.5 for women. That's a huge move for a median to move for 4.5 years. This reflects a major change in a variety of things that I think contribute, but a main one is the strong move of women into the labor force in the 1970s. In the 1950s, it was conventional that you would maybe work for a couple years as a woman and then find a husband and marry, have children, and basically leave the labor force. This is no longer the pattern. And so with the rise of a much more independent situation for women in that they have their own resources, they are seeking their own occupational careers and so on, it really puts a lot more stress on finding a relationship that can survive the stress of trying to manage two careers in a way that is going to allow both parties to pursue actively their best advantage.
Now, one of the things that you did is create the idea of two markets where single men and single women could relate to each other. You call them transactional or relational. What would be the sort of street version of those words? How would you describe transactional?
Transactional market is sort of a meat market setting, and basically people go to particular venues such as bars or gyms or places where single people meet, and they're going there often for quite explicit hooking up for usually a short-term relationship. The relational market, in contrast,
We leave the transactional one, though, what it seems that you're also getting in your responses from people is that there's a lot less stigma attached to that in terms of shame or hiding that, or, oh my gosh, I had to go and find a date in a bar. People are saying, that's what I wanted. I wanted a sex. I wanted a short-term relationship. I met this girl. I met this guy at the health club, and that was it.
No, it is indeed much, much easier to talk about it in these terms. I think what's come on the scene is that adults who are single are obviously looking for sexual partners in a variety of contexts. They, in the heterosexual community, there still is a strong bias toward attempting to find someone for a longer-term relationship. But it is often difficult to do that. The relational market is a way of... Is really not as self-conscious as the meat market or the transactional market, in the sense that people are going to school or they're working and they meet people in the normal course of their work lives or school lives, and eventually it may develop into a sexual relationship. They know a lot about the person. Principal strategy is, of course, someone who knows both you and the partner, a potential partner, know each other and sort of act as a matchmaker. And that helps to eliminate some really bad matches right up front, because you have a basis for knowing something about the other party that isn't just what you can see.
All right, Professor, this is a great place to bring Ethan Waters in. Ethan is author of a book called Urban Tribes, A Generation Redefines Friendship, Family, and Commitment. Ethan, I think urban tribes is your phrase, isn't it?
It is. I launched it over a couple years ago in the New York Times Magazine.
We sure hear it a lot now. Ethan's joining us from the studios of KQED in San Francisco. And Ethan, in defining that, it started out when you realized that your adult life wasn't very much like your parents' adult life.
Exactly. I was in my mid-30s, and I looked at sort of the difference of where I was in my life to where my parents were. And I realized that there was a huge gap. They were already settled down with children when they were my age. And I began to look around and see that was true of many of the friends I had in San Francisco. So I sort of began to wonder, I think. I was also reading Robert Putnam's book, Bowling Alone, which makes the case that my generation of young adults are not doing their part in community building and joining the organizations that my parents did. And I looked at the two facts that I didn't have a family and that I was not indeed part of these community organizations. And I began to wonder why I was so relatively happy living in the city, and why San Francisco felt like such a warm and manageable home. And I began to look around for the social structures that were there in my life, and I identified this group of friends as the sort of the key social structure. And I thought, you know, I think this group of friends is working in a different way than groups of friends maybe work in other times of our life. It has filled the vacuum that was left by the fact that I had no kin network in San Francisco, the fact that I didn't belong to these social organizations, my jobs were episodic, and into that vacuum came this group of friends, which allowed me to really lead a very fulfilled life in San Francisco during all those years that I was single.
Tell me how you see the two frameworks that Professor Laumann has set up of transactional relationships, the meat market as he refers to it, and the relational connections. Does that fit within that construct of an urban tribe?
I think it does, and I'm very excited about his study, because I think we are in desperate need of understanding this demographic. Even people in the demographic itself are very anxious about what's going on. They're confused, especially by the dating market and how they should be managing this. We need to know what's happening in there, just to begin to give us a lexicon for understanding it, like transactional and relational. But to answer your question, I think most of the people I know, and Professor Laumann splits us into a lot of different groups in the city. I happen to be a white, college-educated professional, which is a sub-demographic of what he studies. But I think most of the people I've seen have actually existed in both those markets, although I'd have to say that I don't know a lot of people who, even if they would go into that transactional market, were not at least maybe fooling themselves into the idea that maybe in that transactional market, in that bar or health club, that there would be not only the person for the hookup, but the person that might be that true love. So I don't know if they were fooling themselves, but they were certainly in both those markets. And most of the people that ended up with a happy coupling tended to be in that relational market where it was a friend of a friend. And that is one of those cases where, at least in my group of people in these urban tribes that I've studied, you rely very much not on your family or on your, you know, coworkers. You rely on your chosen community of friends to find that person for you.
And Edward Laman, tell me how you see this information that you've gathered and your conclusions. How is it going to work politically in the country? If as I said, that we've got our policymakers captivated with the idea of marriage and this enormous group of the population, so less concerned with that?
Well, they're less concerned with it because in some ways it's not possible to pursue a sensible course to finding a marriage partner in the 20s because people are still completing their schooling, they're still trying to sort out their work objectives and aspirations and so on, so that the very idea that you could find someone for life when so many parameters of your life are changing makes this a very unlikely short, a return to a lower level, a lower age of marriage is just simply not a plausible scenario the way we experience our lives at the present time. I think the comments about the urban tribes there and the role of friends and so on is very close to the mark of our studies as well. It really puts in the flesh many of the things that we observed. One thing, though, I do want to sort of underscore here is the fragility of these relationships in the single scene. There's a lot of concurrency. The data we have suggests that about 20% of the population, and this is for Cook County, don't have a current partner in the past year. So they're sort of on the sidelines. They're going to come in one way or the other during the course of over the years, but for the time being, they're not. And about 65% are in a mutually monogamous sort of relationship, but 35% of the people who have partners are in various kinds of concurrent relationships, and that has some pretty strong implications. And one of the things that we bring to the story is the issue of sexual jealousy.
Sexual jealousy and domestic violence and other aspects that come along with particularly fragile relationships. It's key in understanding what it is that Professor Laumann and his researchers are pulling together in this particular study, because it's identifying not only the numbers of single versus married, but how the different relationships are working within those communities. We'll talk further when we come back about how it plays out politically in the country. We do, though, want to hear your own perspectives of how it's working within your own circle of friends within your neighborhood. 1-800-423-8255 is the number to join us. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And it is talk about understanding America's new single scene based on some new research, which is called Chicago Health and Social Life Survey. The man in charge of that, Professor Edward Laumann, is with us. We also have Ethan Waters, author of Urban Tribes, A Generation Redefines Friendship, Family, and Commitment, talking about it from his perspective in San Francisco. We would, though, however, like to hear your perspective. So we're going to go next to Marblehead, Massachusetts, and Peter's joining us on the line. Peter, thanks for calling.
Hi, Dick. One of the unseen consequences of this is a steady upward pressure on housing prices, at least here in Massachusetts, where in the state the population's only increased, I think, 5% in the past 10 years, but the demand for housing has increased 40%. A lot of that now comes from single women who previously would have been living with somebody or renting an apartment, and that has a consequence of pushing up prices across the board.
Some of the statistics, Peter, are bearing out in really powerful numbers what you're talking about. One that I read indicates that within 5 years, in the next 5 years, a third of all U.S. households will be occupied by singles, men, women. But that's an unbelievable contrast to, you know, going back to the time when our parents bought their first house when 80% of those homes were occupied by married people. So you're seeing it in the real estate market in a big way.
Yes, whereas before a single woman might have been renting an apartment or getting a small place until she hooked up with somebody, mm-hmm. now she's looking to get a house as a lifelong commitment with just, well, I'm going to live alone for the rest of my life, maybe, and that's okay.
Or I'm certainly going to buy a house for the period of time that I am going to be alone, because it's silly not to take advantage of what the particular economic edge would be to homeowners. And Peter, I want to bring Michelle Conlon in now. She's joining us on the line from New York. She's an associate editor at Businessweek magazine. And in fact, Michelle wrote the late October cover story entitled Unmarried America. Michelle, it's nice to have you with us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
You know, people say, as Peter has and as these numbers show, that our economy and government structures and society itself is weighted in favor of the married person. I know that's one reason you started out doing research for the story, but what did you find?
Well, I found, to put it very simply, that we are a queer eye for the straight guy society living in a world of Leave It to the Beaver, the era, social infrastructure policies in corporate America, governmental policies. I mean, just to step back a bit, you know, we have slipped from nearly 80% of households being married couple households in the 50s to now just 50.7% today, which means we are, in fact, despite our infatuation with marriage culturally, on the verge of becoming a nation of singletons. Yet there's this gigantic disconnect between the reality of the population and the social infrastructure that has grown up to accommodate the population.
Were you surprised at just how many little subparagraphs of the tax code and other places you found our society kind of favoring married people?
I really was. I had an anecdotal hint that there was rising tension in workplaces because, viewed one way, singles subsidize married people in the workplace. And I knew that there were tensions about that. I knew that as people were marrying later, people were foregoing having children or having children on their own, that was a rising tension. What surprised me was to find out how deep and how long the tentacles stretch into everything from Social Security to the estate tax to credit and housing discrimination. Those things surprised me a lot.
And Ethan Waters, if you can take me back to the talk within your own urban tribe, are these features of frustration for people who are trying to find their way as singles?
You know, I'm not sure they are as of yet, because I think fundamentally these people that are single desire marriage, feel that marriage is their birthright, that it's in their future. I don't think, even though, you know, people have spent 10 or 15, or in my case, you know, 20 years being single, there's not this sense of having decided not to get married for most people. So I think they know that there's a sort of a discrimination against single people, but they don't count on being in that category for, you know, hopes are springs eternal in the human heart. And you think, well, for the next 6 months, I'll probably be single, but, you know, in a year or two, I'll likely not be. So there's not this, you don't find people mobilizing on that topic.
I think, I just want to chime in. I think Ethan made an excellent point of that in his book, which is one of the reasons why there hasn't been more mobilization, which is that, you know, most of us will now spend more of our lives single than we will married, which is a huge change. But because I think most of us harbor that, you know, desire for some sort of lifelong partnership, groups like the American Association of Single People have had trouble sort of getting the message out, sort of, you know, wake up. But I think where it is gaining more traction is in the workplace and over things like healthcare and over things like singles saying, why should I be subsidizing my married coworker who has four kids, or why should I be getting less tasty assignments because I don't have a family to go to at night. And I think that's where it's waking up a little bit.
1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Lexington, Massachusetts now. Jennifer's joining us. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, Dick. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling.
Well, this is all very interesting because, and especially the title of the show, Sex and the City, whenever people say it, I say, well, I don't need to watch it because I live it, you know. and really, I mean, I feel it's not a choice. It's a cultural change because it really isn't a choice that we make. It sort of happens. And this urban culture that people are talking about, the network of friends being more important than family or being as important as family, I think for me, in my mind, sort of sprung up from the fact that I come from an immigrant family, you know, not my generation, not my parents' generation, but the generation before that. So there isn't this sort of home-centered culture where people stay where they're brought up for generations, you know. It's very new.
And when you try to make sense of the time, the leisure time that you have and how you spend it and where that friend fits and whether or not you're going to buy a house and all that sort of thing, Jennifer, are you doing that on a sort of month-to-month basis, on a year-to-year basis? Are you doing it with, as Ethan was saying, something in the back of your mind that eventually you're going to get married, you're just not going to worry about it now?
Yes, exactly. I mean, I would like to get married, and I lived with somebody for 5 or 6 years, and it didn't work out, and we owned a house together, and then I moved, and now I'm renting, and I'd like to buy something, but the prices are too high. And, you know, I'm dating somebody now, and actually, Dick, I met you at a speed dating event where you were doing a story.
I remember that. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Are you still speed dating then, Jennifer?
No, I did the speed dating once, and I met somebody at that event, and we dated for about 6 weeks. And I've gone through a string of these type of, you know, meet somebody at either, you know, that type of event or some other, you know, dating club or internet dating.
Yeah.
And now I've met somebody through another dating, you know, club type of thing, and we're really actually a couple.
Just one quick question, Jennifer, and that is when the professor talks about setting up these two frameworks to understand singles relationship, one being transactional, basically short-term, more sex-oriented, the other being relational. Does
that
fit?
I think that's outdated.
You think it's outdated? Why?
Most of the singles that I know are not out there looking for just sex. People want to have a relationship. They don't necessarily want to get married tomorrow or next month or next year even, but they want to have a steady relationship. They eventually want to have a family, but people are a little bit more realistic about what the environment is these days. And I think it's a cultural shift that sort of happens not intentionally, but just as a reaction to economics and other factors, you know, being that the culture is not a home-centered culture, you know,
Let me, if I can, turn to the professor here and let him bring the research to bear here. When she says it, that those two constructs might be a little bit outdated, Professor, what would you say?
Well, I don't really know what when I mean relational market, I mean precisely what she's describing. That is, people heterosexual people particularly are more apt to want to find an ongoing relationship. It is not required that they're looking for a marriage partner by any means, but certainly they want an ongoing relationship. For one thing, it's a lot more efficient to gain sexual access if you are living with someone and on an ongoing basis. Dating without living together is just a very more episodic effect on sexual activity, for one thing. So I don't see that we're talking differently about it. I think that there is a hybrid situation moving out here where people, because the nature of the relationships that can be formed, because everyone's being tentative and they have to keep their options open for other considerations, don't make the kind of investment in the relationship itself so that they keep an eye open for some attractive alternatives, and that the occurrence of concurrent relationships, that is overlapping sexual partnerships, is a very common pattern here, and that is what gets associated with jealousy, and we're talking about a 30% incidence of jealousy. And since jealousy is very much associated with increased levels of physical violence being likely, it triples the likelihood of that if that's a conflict in the relationship. That is the one of the downsides of this situation.
Ethan and Michelle, the professor has referred a couple of times now to the nature of these short-term relationships as being more volatile, perhaps more dangerous, more prone to some kind of violence. Go ahead, Michelle.
Oh, I was just going to say, I wonder though, you know, when I think about that, I think that we have better research and we can capture data like that better now. And I think that violence and volatility have always been a part of relationships. What I will say, though, when our caller was talking, what I was thinking about was that, you know, marriage used to have this huge component, which was an economic component. And now that we have, you know, 1 in 3 wives out earning their husbands and women have just gained such traction in the workforce, the whole compact has really changed. And I think one of the reasons people are waiting longer and it feels like it's harder to find that person is that we're bringing more of a standard to bear in the relationship. We don't just want it to be an economic transaction. We want a meeting of the minds. We want a spiritual, emotional partner. We want a best friend. And so the search feels more arduous because it can be harder to find that person than, say, in the 50s when the standard was had a bigger economic component to it, and women married a lot of the times because they needed that economic security for themselves and their kids.
Mm-hmm. Ethan, probably important here, too, to do as I think the professor is suggesting and widen our lens on this beyond people who have the means to live well and single in a city to include, you know, single moms with kids in lower income parts of the city. I mean, that's a whole part of the single scene as well, right?
Absolutely. And I think one of the interesting things about the study is that he's taken a look at these different sort of demographic slices of city life and found remarkably different sexual behavior in each of those. And I'd be interested to hear the professor talk more about that, particularly in terms of that 35% concurrent relationship, which is a startling statistic for me, because I honestly don't think over one-third of my friends are having multiple partners at a given time in their life. Maybe in my demographic it's lower, but I'm curious where those concurrent relationships and what demographic groups you're seeing this behavior, this polygamous behavior.
Well, it's fairly widespread. There certainly are groups that have higher rates of this. Marriage in the African-American community has been plummeting as a rate since the 1970s for a variety of larger economic reasons and that have rendered many jobless and therefore taking on economic responsibilities for a marriage just becomes a problem. So there is clearly a group that has, given that they're single, that they have overlapping partners, that will be, our estimate is about 250 days of concurrent overlap compared to the white population, which is about 10 days. So there's very different kinds of responses to this, and I think it's very important to remember that there are very important socioeconomic factors here that many of the...
Can I clarify one thing on the concurrent partner thing that I want to make sure I understand? When you say that there are people in some demographics and racial groups that have larger numbers of concurrent partners, that means that, say, a guy sleeps with a number of women, but does it also mean that that guy we're talking about has one particular partner, or is this just... Are we talking about a guy who's going from woman to woman to woman? Do you see what I mean when you talk about concurrent partners?
No, I mean, I'm talking about where they would live for a period of time with one woman.
Right.
They might have shorter relationships with others at the same time.
But then come back to that woman?
And they may actually have several women that they sort of circulate among over time. And they come back to them. They may have a fight. And basically move away, and then they may come back. So these are fairly long-term patterns.
Okay, I want to get back to our phone lines, 1-800-423-8255. Raleigh, North Carolina, Clyde's calling in. Hi, Clyde, thanks for calling.
Hi, great program you're having today. Interesting because me and my roommate kind of fall into this rather interestingly. We're both 32, male. We're best friends, and neither one of us has any intention of getting married in the foreseeable future. And my roommate recently came upon a study. I can't remember where he saw it, but it had mentioned that we are part of this emerging new demographic of 30-somethings males who are kind of fed up or disillusioned with the whole relationship and marriage and are just kind of going through life, you know, as singles. And
why disillusioned then, Clyde?
Well, the study had basically pointed to the feminist movement, not saying that the feminist movement was bad, but it's such a radical change in our society in a relatively short amount of time that what we're seeing now with people like myself and my roommate is kind of this you know, transitional period where things are just different now. I mean, people just aren't getting married or staying married anymore. My roommate and I have actually considered the idea of, instead of marriage, why not have like a marriage contract where you hook up for 5 years, and if you, after that 5 years, you want to continue on, you renew it, kind of thing. But both him and I are just, you know, we're tired with the dating scene. It's easier for us to just stay home than go bother with the hassle of a relationship these days.
And so when the president says, hey, everybody needs to get married, what are you hearing?
It's going in one ear and out the other because I'm not listening to that. It's just, I'm just not interested in being married. I think it's too much of a hassle, and I guess it's kind of a little bit of a bit of laziness on my part, but
it's comfortable.
Yeah, it's comfortable. All right.
Clyde, thanks for calling.
Thank you.
1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, we're taking a look at the latest data as it describes a growing single population in this country. I'm trying to make sense of that with your input and that of my guest. 1-800-423-TALK for you to join us. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's your invitation to join my conversation this hour with Edward Laumann. He's professor of sociology at the University of Chicago, lead author on the Chicago Health and Social Life Survey, which, if you're interested in, is going to be included in a forthcoming book. And the title of that book is The Sexual Organization of the City. Ethan Waters is with us from KQED in San Francisco. He's the author of a book called Urban Tribes, A Generation Redefines Friendship, Family, and Commitment. And Michelle Conlon's also with us. She's an associate editor at Business Week magazine and author of a cover story from late last year called Unmarried America. Michelle, I want to start with you on what we just heard from Clyde about the choices that he's making, because I'm trying to get a sense in my mind whether or not you see that as absence of pressure from family to make a commitment, a freedom on his part to just say no even if there is the pressure. How do you make sense of it?
I see it more as one of the consequences of what I like to think of this period we're in, which is relational creative destruction, where all the old paradigms have kind of gotten shredded. And because of that, there are some men who have perhaps a hesitancy, maybe even an aversion, like our caller. There's some men, there's been research done about men fearing that they'll get a bad deal with divorce laws. And, you know, it used to be for a man that you could get married and it was a great deal. Your wife cooked your meals and starched your shirts, and she probably didn't have a job, so there was no threat of her leaving you. She didn't have any economic power in the relationship, and so there was a greater power accrued to the man. And now I think there's a perception among some men, that it can be a really bad financial deal. They don't have as much power in the transaction. Mm-hmm. What does the new relationship look like? It's uncomfortable. It's scary. It's weird. And we're sort of on this new ground. And then, P.S., if there is a divorce, I think there's a perception among some men that they're really going to be on the hook. Perhaps they feel unfairly for the rest of their lives. And so we're sort of in this new ground territory.
And Ethan Waters, one of the things that you point out in your book, Urban Tribes, is that marriage is no longer that access to sex that it might have been a few decades ago.
No, all sorts of meanings for marriage have dropped away. The access to sex, the financial security for women, the social status, the entryway into adulthood, all of that is just marriage has been stripped of all those meanings. And really all that we have left is this idea of the soulmate. We're very romantic about a marriage. And I wonder whether, you know, Clyde's off the phone now, so this is sort of unfair to talk about him. But I wonder whether Clyde is actually just looking back at his life and sort of retroactively giving an explanation for his belief, for his situation, which is he's 32, he's not married. And he's looking at it and saying, well, maybe I just don't want to be married. But I really wonder whether he or there is a huge amount of men like him that have actually given up on the idea. I wonder if Clyde
But what's your experience, Ethan, when you make a reference to marriage as being a gateway to adulthood? Is the delay of marriage also a delay of growing up?
I don't think so. I think we're in this awkward period of redefining what that period is. And you know, it's a whole spectrum of things because people do it differently in all sorts of different lives. Some people, it's simply a continuation of a certain immaturity and a desire to continue your college years. But I don't think, honestly, that's the norm. I think a large number of people are doing remarkable things with this time. They are living full lives and interesting careers, and they're finding ways to be creative in the city and give love back to their friends and right. their family. And we simply haven't told the stories yet of what those people are doing with that time, which is why we're so nervous about it and why we have the stories that are being told, the Ally McBeal stories and the Seinfeld stories and the Friends stories are all sort of speak to a certain anxiety and immaturity that's out there. But I think there's another story to be told.
Yeah, I was reading today in the newspaper that the people who are filming the last Friends episode, and I think that's tomorrow, are doing it in the utmost secrecy and, you know, I'm in all this sort of delight of or what it's going to mean. But, I mean, let's face it, popular culture in many ways has helped people define where they fit in society. 1-800-423-8255 to Northampton, Massachusetts now. Mary's joining us. Thanks for calling, Mary.
Hi. I wanted to bring another issue into the mix. I find it interesting that with all this talk about single people in marriage that the idea of gay relationships hasn't come up at all. And one of the guests earlier said that heterosexual people are more apt to want to find a long-term relationship, but with the somewhat exception of Vermont and the possible exception of Massachusetts in a few months, heterosexual people are the only people whose long-term relationships are recognized in any way. And gay people have never been able in this country to have those relationships recognized in a way that gives them any of the legal or economic benefits of marriage that we've been talking about.
That's interesting. I just wanted to jump in, if that's okay.
Go ahead, Michelle.
I just thinking about this couple that I profiled in my story, they were a gay male couple. They had two children. They were both white shoe lawyers in Boston. In fact, one of them wrote the amicus brief for the Massachusetts case. The legal arduousness of what they had to go through to make sure their children were secure if anything happened. I mean, it was just incredible what they had to go through because they had none of the protections of a regular family. And if they hadn't been lawyers and hadn't had high salaries, it was something they probably never could have done.
And Professor, in your study of people in the Chicago area, what you're marking is the lifestyles, the lives lived as you saw them. Now, would you say to Mary that it was... If you were to sum up the data without getting too far into the numbers, that homosexual relationships tended to be much more short term.
Yes, I think it's fair to say that the center of gravity is around short term relationships. It's what we call a transactional market. It's for the male homosexual, however, lesbian relationships tend to be relational and are much more into relational issues in markets. And so the idea of just same gender preferences.
So longer term
is not,
as well for lesbians?
Yeah, longer term, that's the ideal preference there. So there's certainly a substantial proportion of people who are interested in long-term relationships, but I would say what's fair to characterize the community at least public norms to be much more permissive about transactional relationships.
And, statistically speaking, do gay and lesbian relationships have an effect in the numbers here? Do we see them when we mark signals?
Oh, the relational numbers for lesbians is quite low. For the gay males, it's the very high numbers of partners reported.
I have an interesting number to throw out there if you'd like to hear it.
Go ahead, Mary. Oh, is that Michelle? Sorry, go ahead.
Sorry. That, you know, one of the reasons we're shifting into this nation of single households is because there's been, one of the reasons, because there's been growth in more non-traditional families. For example, gay male couples with children has increased, among gay males, has increased 5% to 22%. That's probably a low number. The numbers are, I think, a little bit artificially low. And for lesbian couples with kids, it was 22% in 1990 up to 34% in 2000. And one could deduce that in a relationship where there are children involved, there is definitely a desire to have a long-term partnership.
Mary, did you want to get a last word in here?
Yeah, I consider myself to be married. I am a lesbian, and I was married 2 years ago to my partner, and this was not this is still not a relationship that is recognized by my state, by the federal government, obviously, and so we have to pay separate taxes. Luckily, I'm a graduate student, and my union allows for her to be on my health insurance. But I don't think that our relationship is being counted in a lot of these statistics that are coming out, as are many other gay relationships. And if we're not allowed to say that we are married, then those single numbers will continue to rise artificially, I think. And I'd like for people to consider that as they're thinking about their own relationships. What's being counted? What's really being looked at? Mary, we're talking about marriage or singleness.
Thanks for your call. Nice to have you on. 1-800-423-8255. Next to Baton Rouge, Louisiana, Mary Beth, you're with us. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to say, both where I used to live and here, I'm very often the only married woman in various groups of women that I hang around with. And
those groups of women being a sort of urban tribe, would that be a way of describing them, Mary Beth?
No, not really.
Okay.
Excuse me. I have a knack for finding the small town element in the cities, I guess. Disparate groups, disparate sorts of women friends that, you know, don't always intersect except through me, I guess, is the way to put it. But anyway, whether they're divorced without kids, divorced single moms, never been married, mostly straight, sometimes lesbian, when anybody has a first date coming up, the conversation, I'm just sitting there in awe, the conversation always seems to turn to the strategy of what to wear. It's like, you want to look good enough but you don't want to look so provocative that you get hit on too much,
You want to dress for a relational date, not a transactional date.
I guess. I'm 53, so my era, I guess, was different. But most of the women, I guess my youngest close friend is 41.
Will some people say in this little gathering, Mary Beth, that maybe I'm just going to dress for sex on this date rather than dress to get someone who would be a long-term relationship?
No. Even the women I know who are divorced and were so unhappily and don't really want to get married again would very much like long-term relationships that are monogamous, just without the legal end of things. But I don't think any of my friends are really, they're not looking for a few weeks of rolling about. they're all professional women, graduate degrees, MBAs and PhDs and such, and they all seem to take life seriously. And yet, I'm kind of I'm kind of a turtleneck and corduroy kind of person because I come from central New York despite living here on the first day of spring in January.
Mary Beth, let me, if I can, just take the point that you've raised and ask Ethan in here because Ethan, though she doesn't describe her that connection of friends as an urban tribe, that whole nature of it being the group that counsels other people, that's a way that you use to define it.
Right. No, exactly. I like that idea of the group of women sitting around and strategizing for the day because we really do look to these connections of friends to sort of figure out this dating market, which is very confused. And there's all the signposts are down for how to do it. And what do? We go to our friends and we try to figure it out and we try to create stories about it. And that's why when I think about the president's, you know, desire to convince people to get married or convince people to change their sexual behaviors in some ways, I feel like it's sort of a fool's errand because you're going to have to – there is no sort of way to sort of, I think, influence culture at large at this point. And I think Laumann's study points this out, that we're separated in all these little subcultures, and all these little subcultures have all their different rules. And to try to impact that, try to get through all the way down to those little subcultures which are defining the rules of modern mating behavior, it's just I think it would be a waste of money because I don't think it would be possible to do.
And Michelle, as the professor says in his study or in interpreting it, sex is local. You don't get maybe to make policy in Washington that fits it all.
That's right. I mean, on the one hand, however, you know, as far as the Washington component comes in, there are lots of things that I think over the course of the next 10 and 20 years will be addressed. For example, our caller from Northampton, the lesbian woman, you know, she considers herself married, but God forbid if anything were to happen to her partner, run over by a car or something like that, she would have no legal recourse because there are no rights, victims' protection rights for unmarried surviving spouses. There are no state tax breaks for she and her partner. They have to pay transfer taxes. There are fewer job benefits. She's lucky she can write her partner under her health insurance, but that's still unusual. And I think that if you take a look at some of the legislation circulating in Washington, you'll see that there are movements afoot to start changing these mismatches of social policy with the social reality.
All right. We're out of time. I want to thank all three of you for being with me on the program today. I'm sure we'll talk more about this. Michelle Conlon, Edward Laumann, Ethan Waters, my guests today as we talked about this new single Definition in America. Special thanks to the University of Chicago and KQED in San Francisco for technical assistance with today's program. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
All my friends are married, every Tom and Dick and Harry. Must be strong if it'll go it alone. It's to the bachelors and the Bowery bums and those who feel that they're the ones that are better off without a wife. I've been sleeping until the crack of noon, midnight howling at the moon, going out when I want.